Ladies and gentlemen, those of you with particularly good eyesight and hearing will be aware that I am not Nigel Bowles. Nigel is the director of the Rothermere American Institute and has been for the last couple of years. He's been sadly called away. His mother is unwell. And he's asked me if I would stand in his stead. I am Richard Cowardine. I sit on the Rothermere American Institute executive. I was, up until December, Rhodes Professor of American History, so I have some American credentials, but no very evidently literary ones. The Rothermere American Institute really has played a huge part in my life since I came to Oxford in 2002. It is one of Oxford's jewels. Under Nigel's leadership, it really has taken off in the last few years. And this evening, it's such a great pleasure to be introducing the Esmond Harmsworth Annual Lecture, one of a number of named lectures that we have here in the Institute. We have a huge debt of gratitude to the extended Rothermere Harmsworth family. Our speaker tonight is C.K. Williams, who will need, as they say, little introduction to very many of you. C.K. Williams was born and grew up in and around Newark, New Jersey. He graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, where he majored in philosophy and English. He's, of course, as you well know, published many books of poetry. These include Repair, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in the year 2000. The Singing won the National Book Award for 2002, and Flesh and Blood won the National Book Critics Circle Prize in 1987. He's been awarded a remarkably arm-length number of awards and prizes, including the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, a Guggenheim Fellowship, various grants both in the United States and abroad. C.K. Williams teaches in the Creative Writing Program at Princeton University. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and is currently a Chancellor of the American Academy of Poets. It gives me very great pleasure to ask C.K. Williams to deliver the Esmond Harmsworth Annual Lecture for 2010. His title is A Life in Poems.
My original title was Some Masters and Their Influences. I asked a lot of American poet friends who were their influences, and my plan was to read a poem of each of theirs and then several of their influences. And by the time I got straight, I realized I would have to read for about 3 hours. And I had the feeling that you wouldn't be ready for that. So my second choice was, I noticed a title on a book on my desk, So-and-So, A Life in Poems. So I decided I would give you A Life in Poems, which is basically my life as I've lived it privately and to some extent publicly in my poetry. I had a friend, a sociologist named Irving Goffman, who was very esteemed in his field, but like many social studies people, actually didn't have much connection to poetry. And when I gave him my first book, he said, "How can you talk so much about yourself?" Which I thought was a staggering question, actually. And I spent months and months trying to figure out how one justifies talking about oneself so much. And it remains a mystery. I just published the book on Walt Whitman. And of course, Walt Whitman is the great first person of all poetry, and I compared him to Archilochos, you know, who was invented the first person in Western poetry anyway. And the question is, why would someone talk about themselves when they had the Iliad and the Odyssey to talk about? You would think that would be enough. But there's this amazing thing that happens with the first person that somehow we connect to that individual person in a very intimate way that we don't to the epics. And in fact, I wondered in the book whether the first person, the person might have been invented by the first person poetry. Maybe before that, people didn't quite realize that they had persons or were persons. So I'm going to read a few hundred poems about my life in poetry. I have some that start at the very beginning, but I'll start from the beginning of my writing poetry and some early family life as well. It's called My Mother's Lips. Until I asked her to please stop doing it and was astonished to find that she not only could, but from the moment I asked her, in fact, would stop doing it. My mother, all through my childhood, when I was saying something to her, something important, would move her lips as I was speaking, so that she seemed to be saying under her breath the very words I was saying as I was saying them. Or even more disconcertingly, wildly so, now that my puberty had erupted before I said them. When I was smaller, I must just have assumed that she was omniscient. Why not? She knew everything else. When I was tired or lying, she'd know I was ill before I did. I may even have thought, how could it not have come into my mind, that she caused what I said. All she was really doing, of course, was mouthing my words a split second after I said them myself. But it wasn't until my own children were learning to talk that I really understood how, and understood too the edge of anxiety in it, the wanting to bring you along out of the silence, the compulsion to lift you again from those blank caverns of namelessness we encase. That was long afterward, though. Where I was now was just wanting to get her to stop. And considering how I brooded and raged in those days, how quickly my teeth went on edge, the restraint I approached her with seems remarkable, although her so unprotestingly, readily taming a habit by then three children and a dozen years old was as much so. It's endearing to watch us again in that long ago dusk, facing each other, my mother and me. I'd just grown to her height or just past it. There are our lips moving together. Now the unison suddenly breaks. I have to go on by myself. No maestro, no score to follow. I wonder what finally made me take umbrage enough or hard enough to confront her. It's not important. My cocoon at that age was already unwinding, the threads ravel and snarl. When I find one again, it's that 2 o'clock in the morning, a grim hotel on a square, the impenetrable maze of an endless city, when really alone for the first time in my life, I found myself leaning from the window, incanting in a tearing whisper what I thought were poems. I'd love to know what I raved that night to the night, what those innocent dithyrambs were, or to feel what so ecstatically drew me out of myself and beyond. Nothing is there, though, only the solemn piazza beneath me, the riot of dim-tiled roofs and impassable alleys, my desolate bed behind me, and my voice, hoarse, and the sweet alien air against me. Like a kiss. I wrote a series of poems called Of Childhood the Dark, trying to go back to remember or reinvent what it was to become aware of really being yourself. And there's a series of poems. I'll read the first and the last. The first one is called Here. They're very abstract and a little difficult to follow, but I'm sure at Oxford we can do that. Uncanny to realize one was here. So much came before the awareness of being here. Then to suspect your place here was yours only because no one else wanted or would have it. A sight, a setting. And you the matter to fill it. though you guessed it could never be filled. Therefore, as much as a presence, you were a problem, a task, insoluble, so optional, so illicit. Then the first understanding that you yourself were the difficult thing to be done. And the last poem of the series is about past. It's called Tenses. Then seemingly all at once, there was a past of which you were more than incidentally composed. Opaque, dense, delectable as oil paint, fauceted from a source it itself generated in you. You were magnified by it, but it could intrude and weigh like an unfathomable obligation. Everything ending waited there, which meant much would never be done with, even yourself. The memory of the thought of yourself you were now, that thought seemingly always hardly begun. So here we are now. That was 2 or 3 years old. Now we're going to hop ahead to my early youth during the Second World War. There's references, the epigraph and for this poem is from the great Japanese poet Basho, and there's other Japanese poets mentioned. I think everything is pretty clear. There's some the names of some World War II airplanes. They had wonderful, crazy names. And it was mentioned I grew up in Newark, and Port Newark was where the planes were gathered to be sent over here. And that they used to practice over Newark. I guess they were practicing bombing us. And so that's all you need to know. There's an epigraph from Basho. In this mortal frame of mine, which consists of 100 bones and 9 orifices, there is something, and this something can be called, for lack of a better name, a windswept spirit. And the poem is called 100 Bones. And thus the 100 bones of my body, plus various apertures, plus that thing I don't know yet to call spirit, are all awake with joyous awe at the shriek of the fighter planes that from their base at Port Newark swoop in their practice runs so low over our building that the walls tremble. Wildcats, they're called, thunderbolts, or corsairs, and they're practicing strafing, which in war means your machine guns are going like mad as you dive down on the enemy soldiers and other bad people, nips, krauts, trying to run out from under your wings, your bullet pops leaping after their feet. Nips and krauts for the younger people, those were nicknames for our enemies, the Japanese and the Germans. Now they're our friends. It's a new word for us, strafing. We learn others too, blockbusters, for instance, which means bombs that smash down your whole block, not our block, some NIP block or Nazi, some gray block in the newsreel. B-24 is the number of my favorite bomber, the Liberator, my best fighter, Lightning. The other kind of lightning once crashed on an eave of our building, and my mother cried out and swept me up in her arms. The war is here, she must have thought. The war has found me. All her life, I think she was thinking, the war is here, the war has found me. Some words we don't know yet. Gas chamber, napalm, children our age in 1944, say Arnold Lillian and I, who are discussing how we'll torture our treacherous enemy friends who've gone off to a ball game without us. They're like enemies, Japs or Nazis, so of course torture. Do children of all times and places speak so passionately and knowledgeably about torture? Our imaginations are small, though, Arnold's and mine. Tear out their nails, burn their eyes, drive icicles in their ears so there's no evidence of your having done it except they're dead. Then it was Arnold who died. He was a doctor, out west. He learned to fly Piper Cubs and flew out to help Navajo women have babies. He'd become a good man. Then he was dead. But right now, victory, V-Day, clouds like giant ice creams over the evil Japanese Empire. Cities are burning. Some Japanese cities aren't even there. The war is here. The war has found me. Japanese poets come later. We don't know we need them until they're already buffing the lens. Basho, Issa, Busson, especially Basho. Ah, that windswept spirit. Ah, that hardly there frog. Adam Baum, though. Basho, a shadow burned into asphalt. House torn by mad burning wind. Poets in coats of straw burning. What is our flaw, we human beings? What is our error? Spikes in your tushy, ice in your brain. That frog invisibly waiting forever to make its leap. This is a more personal one. A little older I am now. Probably they're going to learn more about my life than you ever wanted to. The gaffe. If that someone who's me yet not me, yet who judges me, is always with me, as he is, shouldn't he have been there when I said so long ago that thing I said? If he who rakes me with such not trivial shame for minor sins now were there then, shouldn't he have warned me he'd even now devastate me for my unpardonable affront? I'm a child then, yet already I've composed this conscience beast who harries me. Is there anything else I can say with certainty about who I was, except that I, that he, could already draw from infinitesimal transgressions complex chords of remorse and orchestrate ever undiminishing retribution from the hapless rest of myself? The son of some friends of my parents has died, and my parents, paying their call, take me along, and I'm sent out with the dead boy's brother and some others to play. We're joking around, and words come to my mind, which to my amazement are said. How do you know when you can laugh when somebody dies? Your brother dies, is what's said. And the others go quiet, the backyard goes quiet, everyone stares, and I want to know now why that someone in me who's me yet not me let me say it. Shouldn't he have told me the contrition cycle would from then be ever upon me? It didn't matter that I really only wanted to know how grief ends and when. I could hear the boy's mother sobbing inside, then stopping. Sobbing, then stopping. Was the end of her grief already there? Had her someone in her told her it would end? Was her someone in her kinder to her, not tearing at her as mine did, still does, me, for guessing grief someday ends? Is that why her sobbing stopped sometimes? She didn't laugh, though, or I never heard her. How do you know when you can laugh? Why couldn't someone have been there in me not just to accuse me, but to explain? The kids were playing again. I was playing. I didn't hear anything more from inside. The way sometimes now what's in me is silent too, and sometimes, though never really, forgets. A little warm here. The next poem does need some explanation. It's called Blackstone. Blackstone was a great American magician like Houdini, who lived after Houdini and was flourished in the 30s, 40s, into the 50s. The poem also refers to Newark. Newark, New Jersey, where I grew up, was the first city in America that experienced what we call urban flight, when the black people were sent up from the South and the white people moved to the suburbs, and the governments of all concern were so corrupt and inept that they didn't know what to do about it, basically, and the city was all but destroyed. It was all but also the time of great sexual repression. You can't imagine what sexual repression there was. Those of you who are young are looking at me blankly because you can't imagine it. Blackstone. When Blackstone the magician cut a woman in half in the Branford Theater near the famous Lincoln statue and already partway down the chute Newark, he used a gigantic buzzsaw, and the woman let out a shriek that outshrieked the whirling blade and drilled directly into the void of our little boy crotches. That must be when we learned that real men were supposed to hurt women, make them cry, then leave them, because we saw the blade go in, right in. Her waist was bare, look, and so in her silvery garlanded bra, shining, were her breasts, oh, round, silvery garlanded tops of breasts, shining. Which must be when we went insane and were sent to drive our culture insane. Show me your breasts, please. Shame on you. Hide your breasts. Shame. Nothing else mattered. Just silvery garlanded breasts. And still she shrieked. The blade was still going in under her breasts. And nothing else mattered. Oh, Branford Theater, with your scabby plaster and threadbare scrim, you didn't matter. And Newark, your tax base oozing away to the suburbs, you didn't matter. Nor your government by corruption or swelling slums. You were invisible now. Those breasts had made you before our eyes vanish, as Blackstone would make doves, then a horse, before our eyes vanish, as at the end factories and businesses from our vanquished city would vanish. Oh, Blackstone, gesturing, conjuring with your looming, piercing glare, oh, gleaming, hurtling blade, oh, drawn-out scream, oh, perfect, thrilling arc of pain. This is called Dress, again, about the past. In those days which exist for me only as the most elusive memory now, when often the first sound you'd hear in the morning would be a storm of bird song, then the soft clop of the hoofs of the horse hauling a milk wagon down your block, and the last sound at night, as likely as not, would be your father pulling up in his car, having worked late again, always late, and going heavily down to the cellar, to the furnace, to shake out the ashes and damp the draft before he came upstairs to fall into bed. In those long ago days, women, my mother, my friends' mothers, our neighbors, all the women I knew wore much of the day what were called house dresses, cheap, printed, pulpy, seemingly purposefully shapeless light cotton shifts that you wore over your nightgown, and when you had to go look for a child, hang wash on the line, or run down to the grocery on the corner under a coat, the twisted hem of the nightgown, always lank and yellowed, dangling beneath. More than the curler some of the women seem constantly to have in their hair in preparation for some great event, a ball, one would think, that never came to pass. More than the way most women's faces not only were never made up during the day, but seemed scraped, bleached, and with their plucked eyebrows scarily mask-like. More than all that, it was those dresses that made women so unknowable and forbidding, adepts of enigmas to which men could have no access and boys no conception. Only later would I see those dresses also as a proclamation that in your dim kitchen, your laundry, your bleak concrete yard, what you revealed of yourself was a fabulation, your real sensual nature veiled in those sexless vestments was utterly your dominion. In those days, one hid much else as well. Grown men didn't embrace one another unless someone had died, and not always then. You shook hands or at a ball game thumped your friend's back and exchanged blows meant to be codes for affection. Once out of childhood, you'd never again know the shock of your father's whiskers on your cheek, not until mores at last had evolved and you could hug another man, then hold on for a moment, then even kiss your father's bristles, white and stiff now. What release, finally, the embrace. Though we were wary, it seemed so audacious. How much unspoken joy there was in that affirmation of equality and communion, no matter how much misunderstanding and pain had passed between you by then. We knew so little in those days, as little as now, I suppose, about healing those hurts. Even the women in their best dresses with beads and sequins sewn on the bodices, even in lipstick and mascara, their hair aflow could only stand wringing their hands, begging for peace, while father and son, like thugs, like thieves, like Romans, simmered and hissed and hated, inflicting sorrows that endured the worst anyway, through the kiss and embrace, bleeding from brother to brother into the generations. In those days, there was still countryside close to the city, farms, cornfields, cows, even not far from our building with its blurred brick and long shadowy hallway. You could find tracks with hills and trees you could pretend were mountains and forests. Or you could go out by yourself, even to a half block long empty lot, into the bushes. Like a creature of leaves you'd lurk, crouched, crawling, simplified, savage, alone. Already there was wanting to be simpler, wanting, when they called you, never to go back. So now we move a little older and we discover that there is this thing called race in America, which if you were white in those days, you could actually not know anything about. This happens much later, but it speaks of that issue, that quandary, that disaster. The singing. I was walking home down a hill near our house on a balmy afternoon under the blossoms of the pear trees that go flamboyantly mad here every spring with their burgeoning forth, when a young man turned in from a corner singing. No, it was more of a cadence shouting, most of which I couldn't catch, I thought because the young man was black, speaking black. It didn't matter. I could tell he was making his song up, which pleased me. He was nice-looking, husky, dressed in some style of big pants, obviously full of himself, hence his lyrical flowing over. We went along in the same direction, then he noticed me there almost beside him. And big, he shouted, sang, big. And I thought how droll to have my height incorporated in his song. So I smiled, but the face of the young man showed nothing. He looked, in fact, pointedly away, and his song changed. I'm not a nice person, he chanted. I'm not a nice person. No menace was meant, I gathered, no particular threat, but he did want to be certain I knew that if my smile implied I conceived of anything like concord between us, I should forget it. That's all. Nothing else happened. His song became indecipherable to me again. He arrived where he was going, a house where a girl in braids waited for him on the porch. That was all. No one saw. No one heard. All the unasked and unanswered questions were left where they were. It occurred to me to sing back, "I'm not a nice person either," but I couldn't come up with a tune. Besides, I wouldn't have meant it, nor he have believed it. Both of us knew just where we were in the duet we composed, the equation we made, the conventions to which we were condemned. Sometimes it feels, even when no one is there, that someone, something, is watching and listening, someone to rectify, redo, remake. This time again, though, no one saw nor heard. No one was there. Now the Vietnam War. I actually wrote pretty much a whole book of poems screaming in rage against the Vietnam War. That was the age at which I still believed that poetry could actually change things. You learn later, if it does change things, it's in much different ways from having people yelled at. But I will read one poem. I had a daughter who was born right in the middle of the war, and that was the final blow about the insanity of human beings towards one another. And this is called The Nickname of Hell. It's a shorter poem. The president of my country, his face flushed horribly like a penis, is walking through the schoolyard toward my daughter. I tell him, "Mr. President, I will make it all right," but under his hand, his penis is lined with many buttons. I tell him the orders are changing, but commanders deepen his penis primate. I tell him about love. I tell him there is a new God who believes anything. I cringe alongside him. I dance like a daughter. It is the schoolyard. The daughters play on the dangerous fences. I tell him I love him. I tell him the daughters aren't here even. He is holding me now. His arms hold me, his lips. "You are my bliss," he tells me. "These are my arms, these my lips. You are my penis," he tells me. His face stings into mine like a penis. "You are my joy. You, my daughter, hold me, my daughter, my daughter." So you see, I'm not quite sure. Okay, so we go from Vietnam War to global warming. So this is my next poem. I had a period, this poem actually comes from a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago by now. And a few summers ago, I've been working all summer on a series of poems, and I realized everything I was writing was about global warming. And I thought, how appropriate, but how futile. So I changed. But this is one. There's a thing in America, I guess it's here too, where the whole global warming thing becomes beyond absurd. It becomes surreal. There was a big snowstorm in Washington, D.C. last winter. And the senator who leads the anti-global climate change, the anti-global warming cadre, built a snow house in front of the Congress and said, "See, where's global warming?" And I realized today it will take, I don't know what it will take. I mean, here, this is not the weather we used to have in jolly old England. It will take the whole world igniting before anyone gets ready to do anything about it. There's one part in this poem where I speak of 12 sons, the prophecy's promise. These are sons that come from a Hindu text. I'll just leave it at that. Storm. A another burst of the interminable, intermittently torrential dark afternoon downpour, and the dozens of tirelessly garrulous courtyard sparrows stop hectoring each other and rush to park under a length of cornice endearingly soiled with decades of wing grease. The worst summer in memory, thermal inversion, smog, swelter, intimations of global warming, though the plane trees still thrust forth buds as though innocent April were just blooming, last week's tentative pre-green leaflings are already woefully charred with heat and pollution. Thunder far off, benign, then closer, slashes of lightning, a massive concussive unscrolling, an answering tremor in the breast, the exultation at sharing a planet with this. Than sorrow, that we really might strip it of all but the bare, wounded rock lumbering down its rote rail. A denser veil of clouds now, another darkening downlash, the wind rises, the sparrows scatter, the leaves quake, and oh, I throw myself this way, the trees say, then that way, I tremble, I moan, and still you don't understand the absence I'll be in the void of unredeemable time. 12 suns, the prophecies promise, 12 vast suns of purification will mount the horizon to scorch, sear, burn away, then 12 cosmic cycles of rain, no tree left, no bird song, only the vigilant acid waves vindictively scouring themselves again and again on no shore. Imagine then the emergence, oh this way the sky streaked, oh that way with miraculous brightness. Imagine us beginning again, timid and tender, with a million years more this time to evolve, an epoch more on all fours, stricken with shame and repentance before we fire our forges. Okay, so in the middle, I get married a few times. Once unhappily, once happily. And this is a marriage poem called Back. First I did my thing, that's to say her thing, to her, for her. Then she did her thing, I mean my thing, to me, for me. Then we did our thing together, then again, the other way though, then once more that way again. Then we were done, and we were at dinner, though I desperately miss the other things now and said so. Don't you know I can't enjoy anything else now? And still love tipsy, love stunned, ever, I said, I'll never enjoy anything else ever again. Except I also meant this. I mean this being together thinking of that, or not even her thinking, who knows what she's thinking. I mean me thinking of that, of her thinking and thinking. But now that I've told her, told you, are we then back to again that? Yes, and thank goodness I'm back there, we're back there. I missed you out here by myself, even thinking of that, which is why I had to do all this thinking to take us even in such a partial way back. Iraq War. This is called Cassandra, Iraq. I'm sure you all know Cassandra was the prophetess at Troy who predicted the fall of Troy, but when she spoke, no one could understand her. They heard the sound of birds, basically. And then she was finally taken away by Agamemnon, and Agamemnon was killed, was put in a net by his wife and killed for, among other things, bringing Cassandra back. The poem came out of a conversation I had with some college students in which we were arguing about something, and I suddenly realized that when you're in that age of being educated, being right is terrifically important. And when you get older, being right becomes a much more conditional thing. Often you wish, in fact, you weren't right. Cassandra, Iraq. She's magnificent, as we imagine women must be, who foresee and foretell and are right and disdained. This is the difference between us who are like her in having been right and disdained, and us as we are. Because we, in our foreseeings, are having been right, are repulsive to ourselves, fat and immobile, like toads. Not toads in the garden who, after all, are what they are, but toads in the tale of death in the desert of sludge. In this tale of lies, of treachery, of superfluous dead, were there ever so many who were right and disdained, with no notion what to do next? If we were true seers, as prescient as she, as frenzied, we'd know what to do next. We'd twitter as she did, like birds. We'd warble, we'd trill. But what would it be, really, to twitter, to warble, to trill? Is it E-E-E, like having a child? Is it like a wound? Or is it inside, like a blow, silent to everyone but yourself? Yes, inside, I remember. Oh, 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 it's where grief is just about to be spoken, but all at once can't be. Oh, when you can no longer think of what things like lies, like superfluous dead, so many might mean. Oh, Cassandra will be abducted at the end of her tale and die. Even she can't predict how, stabbed, shot, blown to bits. Her abductor dies too, though, in a gush of gore, in a net. That we know, she foresaw that, in a gush of gore, in a net. First punk of aging. The coffin store. I was lugging my death from Kampala to Krakow. Death, what a ridiculous load you can be, like the world trembling on Atlas's shoulders. In Kampala, I wondered why the people so poor didn't just kill me. Why don't they just kill me? In Krakow, I must have fancied I'd find poets to talk to. I still believed then I'd domesticated my death, that he'd no longer gnaw off my fingers and ears. We even had parties together. Happy, said death, and gave me my present, a coffin, my coffin, made in Kampala with a sliding door in its lid, to look through at the sky, at the birds, at Kampala. That was his way, I soon understood, of reverting to talon and snarl, for the door refused to come open. No sky, no bird, no poets, no Krakow. Katrine came to me then. Katrine is my wife. Katrine came to me then. Came to me then. Open your eyes, mon amour. But death had undone me. My knuckles were raw as an ape's. My mind slid like a sad ankled skate. And no matter what Catherine was saying, was sighing, was singing, mon amour, the door stayed shut. Oh, shut. I heard trees being felled, skin smooth, hammered together as coffins. I heard death snorting and stamping, impatient to be hauled off away. But here again was Catherine sighing and singing, and the tiny carved wooden door slid ajar just enough. The sky, one single. I heard trees being felled, skin smooth, hammered together as coffins. I heard death snorting and stamping, impatient to behold off away. But here again was Catherine sighing and singing, and the tiny carved wooden door slid ajar, just enough. The sky, one single bird, Catherine, just enough. So So now I have grandsons. And I also had a grandfather. Two grandfathers. Most of this is self-evident. I speak about Warhol, of course, is Andy Warhol, and Camus, who of course is Camus, who was killed in an automobile accident. And I speak of Anne Sexton, who was a great American poet, Pollock, Zeeble, Hammerstein, West, Tom Mix, who was a cowboy hero. And I speak of a Chevy, an Olt, I guess in the American Studies Department, you know, that was a Chevrolet and an Oldsmobile. Exhaust. My grandson wants a Ferrari. I buy one for him. Why not? The second, a Mercedes. The third, a Porsche. Why not? How things change. My grandfather wanted only the pickup one icy Rochester night the year before I was born. He skidded through a gate in and plowed head on into a train. My grandson's cars cost a dollar, part of a vast collection of racers, convertibles, trucks, even antiques from the time I had my first car, a five-year-old ungainly green Chevy. Not like Lowell's father's spanking new one with gilded hoofs, wrote Lowell, and slashingly his best friend. I treasured my Chevy too, though it plodded compared with a friend's olds that sped us one New Year's Eve after the parties down the parkway at 110. My grandfather, I gather, was vain of his truck and his driving, but my grandmother would grumble. He was a terrible driver. We were good drivers, we were certain, better than good. Didn't we all but live in our cars? Wasn't the best part even of a date when you made out with your girlfriend in back? Right now, hitting 100, don't we love each other for how our tires are glued to the pavement and life has no end? I hadn't seen Warhol's print yet of mangled teenagers spilled from their wreck. I didn't see much then beyond cars, like my grandsons, who know every make, model, top speed, and 0 to 60 by heart, and who squabble because one has stolen another's X something or other. My grandfather was a socialist when that word still could be used. He even ran for state senate, though not surprisingly lost. He was hardly well off with a store that sold candy and papers, and why he needed that broken down truck my grandmother still complained on her deathbed was a mystery to her. The first time I was almost killed in a car, an axle sheared, our back wheel went bounced past us. We spun out of control over a busy highway and pulled up a yard from a tree, much like the tree in the photo of the death of Camus with his publisher's sports car gruesomely wrapped around it. Such a short time between my automobile madness and my rapture reading Camus, Sisyphus telling me why suicide wasn't the route, though at the time it could seem so. What did he say exactly? I don't think there was much about love, which would be my reason now, love, family, poetry, art. I sometimes imagine my Chevy was devoted to me, like a dog. That was before death arrived, mine and everyone else's. Anne Sexton's father died in a car. Dear Anne made certain too. Pollock, Zeeble, Halberstam, West, Tom Mix, for God's sakes, me nearly four times, and my grandfather, Charles Kasdan, whom for the first time I miss, and whom if I'd been there, I know I could have saved. Pump the brakes gently, I tell him, and we'd glide up to the rails and wait in the beautiful snow. He'd offer some wisdom to hand on to my grandsons, the train clattering by us, the mingling steam of our breath. And the last poem is a poem of gratitude for having gotten to be a poet in the first place and all the people who helped me, who were essential. It's called
called The Foundation. Watch me, I'm running. Watch me, I'm dancing. I'm air. The building I used to live in has been razed, and I'm skipping, hopping, two-footedly leaping across the blocks, bricks, slabs of concrete, plaster, and another unnameable junk. Or nameable, really, if you look at the wreckage closely. Here, for instance, this shattered I-beam is the Bible, and this chunk of mortar, Plato, the mortar of mine, also in pieces in me anyway, in my mind. Aristotle and Nietzsche, Freud and Camus and Buber, and Christ even, that year of reading Paradise Lost when I thought, hell, why not? But that fracture too, Kierkegaard, Hegel, and Kant, and Goffman, and Marx, all heaped in the foundation. And I've sped through so often that now I have it by heart, can run, dance, be air, not think of the spew of intellectual dust I scuffed up when in my barely broken-in boots I first clumped through the sanctums of Buddhism, Taoism, Zen, and the Areopagite even, whose entire text I typed out. My God, why? I didn't care. I just kept bumping my head on the lintels. Einstein, the Gnostics, Kabbalah, Saint this and Saint that. Watch me again now, because I'm not alone in my dancing, my being air. I'm with my poets, my Rilke, my Yeats. We're leaping together through the debris, a jumble of wrack, but my Keats floats across it. My Herbert and Dunn, my Cannell, my Bishop and Blake are soaring across it. My Frost, Baudelaire, my Dickens and Lowell and Larkin, and my giants, my Whitman, my Shakespeare, my Dante and Homer. They were the steel, though scouring as I was the savants and sages half the time I hardly knew it. But Vallejo was there all along, and my Sidney and Shelley, my Coleridge and Hopkins, there all along with their music. Which is why I can whirl through the rubble of everything else, the philosophizing and theories, the thesis and anti and sin. All I believe must be what meanings were made of, when really it was the singing, the choiring, the cadence, the lull of the vowels, the chromatical consonant clatter. Watch me again, I haven't landed. I'm hovering here over the fragments, the remnants, the splinters and shards. My poets are with me, my soarers, my skimmers, my skaters, aloft on their song in the ruins, their jubilant song of the ruins. Thank you.
Those occasions when I've had the privilege of hearing a great poet, as we just have, I just feel how impoverished my own language is and how limited is my imagination. I want to thank you, C.K. Williams, for a wonderful hour of opening up your life and your memories to us. And for an American historian, it's just been wonderful to have that period of your life expressed in that very personal way. This is really a vote of double thanks, because this lecture wouldn't happen were it not for Esmond Harmsworth, who's here today. We want to thank him for his support for this lecture, for making it possible. And to you, sir, for giving us another great lecture in the Esmond Harmsworth Annual Lecture Series. Before I ask you to give a final round of applause, let me invite you all to join us at a reception. I think the weather beckons us out of doors, where we can get an even better view of this splendid facility, the RAI. But once more, let us thank C.K. Williams.